Sunday morning at 8 on Hometown Heroes, an Albuquerque veteran remembers the desperation of the Bataan Death March.
If I have a chance, I'll die trying to escape or escape. And I did that.
Find out how on Hometown Heroes, Sunday morning at 8 on The Rock of Talk.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who, when we take the time to listen to their stories, we are amazed by the things they did for the sake of our freedom. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget that price paid for the freedom we enjoy. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and oftentimes inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And boy, are we in for a story today from 93-year-old Adelano David of Albuquerque, New Mexico, but not from Albuquerque originally, from a small town on the island of Luzon in the Philippines. What was it like growing up in the Philippines in the 1920s and 1930s?
It was quite Americanized because Clark Air Force Base was only about 3 or 4 miles away. And the town had recreation places, and also the population was quite welcome to the Americans. As a matter of fact, one of my cousins married an enlisted man from Clark Air Force Base, and I had access to the golf course, and it was a very nice view of the Zambales Mountains.
And we're going to hear along the way how you would get involved in World War II, how you would escape the Bataan Death March. We've had some survivors on the show, but I don't think I've had anyone who escaped. This is quite a story we're going to hear. And I always ask every veteran, you know, the vast majority of the veterans I talk to grew up in America, and I always ask them about December 7th, 1941. For you, though, I imagine it's December 8th that you remember as a big day where some big things happened where you were.
Yes, the first time that we realized that December 8th happened was we were in San Marcelino, Zambales, with the 3rd Infantry, 31st Division. I was recuperating from malaria, and I was watching a baseball game between one platoon and the other, and a Piper Cub came roaring over the jungle trees and bared down, up and down, and getting our attention, and then we saw him drop a leaflet, and he said Pearl Harbor was bombed that night. We were ordered to evacuate our place, and because we were on the beach defense, we were told to proceed to Bataan December 8th. But we had our troop carriers were really commanded passenger buses, and they had to put covers on the headlights, and somebody had to sit on the hood guiding the trail towards the jungle and then to Bataan.
And that was so you wouldn't be seen by the Japanese?
Yes, and the funny thing about it is we got into the hidden jungle, we had to stop. Suddenly flares came out of the sky, and this is like midnight. And we have, up to now, we never discovered where the flares came from, because it was like daylight highlighting our hidden place.
That had to be a little unnerving. And I guess I should back up a little bit, because I took you right to December 8th on that side of the dateline when the war started in the Philippines. But obviously, you were already involved. You had joined the Philippine Scouts, serving alongside the American military.
It was not the Scouts. It was what was called the Philippine Army at first, and then it was incorporated into USAFE, or United States Armed Forces of the Far East, by order of Roosevelt, and federalizing everything concerning pay and benefits. We became U.S. Army of the Far East, USAFE.
And how old were you when you got involved with that?
I just turned 20.
So this was just a few months before the war started. Did you think a war was coming?
I was 19, and a few months before, which was July, August, I enlisted. July, MacArthur, we had a general gathering of all the ROTC students of Manila. I would say that we had four Ivy League universities with elite ROTCs. I was part of the model company of UST. We were ordered to go to the Rizal Memorial Stadium, which is like a football arena here, to listen to President Quezon, who warned us about the invasion. And he talked about it, and MacArthur came over. And he spoke about, he closed his remarks by saying, some of you will return to their loved ones covered with glory, but some of you will never return. And that was July 4th, 1941.
So while so many people in America were surprised by what happened, you knew something was coming, and you had already been preparing for what was going to happen, huh?
As a matter of fact, it's funny. I wrote a story in July, and I enlisted August. I wrote a story about a soldier dying, and it became the best story of the year in the colleges.
You had an inkling. You were ahead of your time with all that. And then, as folks may know, not long after Pearl Harbor was bombed, Clark Field was hit as well. But you guys, as you said, are being transported to Bataan. Were you starting to get a little nervous? Were you concerned about what was happening here?
At first, I took it for granted, because as a boy, I always welcome adventure. And for me, to join the Army was not from any patriotism or what. I just wanted the adventure. So when I was in the Army, I enjoyed the training, and I was training my men. I was a sergeant. And to me, it was like another Boy Scout trip to me, because I enjoyed the outdoors and being with boys my age.
When did that change? When did you realize that this time it's not a Boy Scout trip?
When we were ordered from Bataan to meet the Japanese transport in Subic Bay, I was in charge of a F platoon, and I was ordered to take the front trench on the beach. It was the break of dawn when we saw on the horizon Japanese troops, carriers and destroyers. Suddenly, as the sun came out, six planes in waves of three began to bomb our place, and I think they were harassed by cannons from Fort Wint and Fort Mirabelis, and they could not aim straight. So their bombs fell about 20 yards from my trench, and I just got covered with sand and water. Anyway, to cut a long story short, it lasted about 6 hours. We drove them away, and a thunderous cheer came from our regiment, that Infantry 31st Division, USAFE. A thunderous cheer came out from everybody because they went away. In the meantime, I had not realized that I was shaking with fear. I could not control my jaw from clacking. I could not control my knees from jumping up and down. And suddenly I found out that I thought I was hit. My leggings were wet, and I was going to call for a medic, but luckily I didn't, because I found out it was not blood. I had wet my pants. Wow. Yeah. But anyway, that was December 12th.
The cheers were because they went away, but things would change from there, and you guys would end up in a dire situation. What was the toughest thing that you encountered over the weeks that followed? Because I've heard stories from guys who talk about not having any supplies, not having anything to eat. The weapons they had were not up to date. They had no ammunition. And this was all before the death march started. How desperate did the situation get for you?
Well, it got desperate when, after repulsing several attempts for them to get our area, we were starving for at least 2 or 3 days. Not enough water, and sometimes just a bowl of rice. But even that was not coming because of combat. And then our General King and some of our leaders asked MacArthur to send us a share from Corregidor of their food, because they were having good supplies like pancake for breakfast an ice cream for dessert. And here we were starving with a bowl of rice, and we were refused. That was the most horrifying thing that we encountered. And I don't know what his motivation was, but he was a general, and we accepted it. And what happened then, suddenly the order was out of this world. He was ordering us like to stand our ground, like the Texas Alamo. Remember the Alamo? We were to stand our ground, and luckily we had a sense of humor. Some of us said, never mind, said, because Superman is coming.
You had to hope in something, I guess, huh?
We had to hope in something, Green Lantern, Captain Marvel. In the trench, you either get your fear or you get to bed shaking and paralyzed.
Before we go further, I'm curious, as a Filipino serving in the American Armed Forces, did you feel that you were treated the same way as anyone else, or did you feel that there was a different way that they looked at you guys because you weren't from the U.S.?
From research that I've looked at in history books, there was some discrimination. We were called gooks and flimps and monkeys. And whenever there was an engagement where Filipinos died by the hundreds, we were never given credit. It was always MacArthur. Of course, to give credit to MacArthur, he never gave credit to his American men either.
What about you personally? Did you feel discrimination, or were the guys you served with treating you the same as anyone else?
I was treated very well because I was a university graduate. So probably there's a difference. But actually, there was no discrimination in my company. As a matter of fact, a Texas lieutenant died for me because I was going on patrol one day, but because the previous day I was on patrol, he said, never mind, I'll take this patrol. He was supposed to return after 2 or 3 days patrolling, looking for snipers. He never returned, so we found his body in the sugarcane field a week later.
I imagine that's a humbling experience and gets your attention a little bit. Before we get to the surrender, can you give us a sense of what the conditions were like? What kind of ammunition, artillery, weapons that you had? I mean, did you feel that you were underprepared, or how did you feel about that?
We were grossly underprepared. Our rifles were too large for the Filipino. To sight the barrel, we had to put the heavy stock on our shoulders, and every time we fired, it bruised our shoulders. And most of the time, because the equipment came from World War I, some of them probably were not properly cleaned, or they were just obsolete. They exploded in our faces, and we had casualties. So the first engagement against the Japanese was a fiasco because we had exploding bombs, rifles. Our machine gun and mortar shells didn't explode. They were duds. So against a veteran army, and really... From Nanking and from Manchuria, and most of our men were farmers and clerks, and some of us didn't even know how to handle a rifle. So we had to retreat from the beach defense to Agno River on North Luzon while we didn't have any more air cover. We lost 350 scouts on the first engagement in Agno River out of 800 because they... on horseback, they fought against tanks.
And these are the stories so many people are unaware of, and I'm so thankful we have you to clue us in a little bit. Were there rumblings of the surrender before it happened, before General King said, yep, this is it?
No, it was a total surprise. Well, most of us cried because we didn't want to surrender. And then when the order came to surrender, a lot of us were still fighting. In spite of the order to surrender, they were bombing us anyway. We were on the last defense on Mount Samat. We lost practically all of our 33rd Infantry was wiped out on Samat. And when I came to me to surrender, I had a choice of going into the mountains because there was a rumor that we could go instead of surrendering. But we couldn't, because if we surrendered, anybody who surrendered was shot anyway. They had orders to kill all prisoners. As a matter of fact, there's a record in the books which says the first surrenderers were about 300 mixed U.S. Army and the Philippine Army. They were massacred, 300 of them, and they had surrendered.
I can't imagine what that feels like to be in a situation where you have to make that decision. And you had family to worry about too, right?
Yes, I had a girlfriend who was waiting, and I didn't know where she was. She didn't know where I was. My father didn't even know I was in the army because I didn't tell him.
What do you think led you to decide what you decided, and how scary and frightening was that?
We decided to surrender because if we went to the mountains, we were blocked anyway, and we could be captured anyway. But when we surrendered, a lot of us went away to the hills, including Colonel Torpy, who became the guerrilla leader in Zambales Mountains. When I escaped from the death march, that's what I joined.
Well, isn't that a great way to enter our first commercial break? We'll discuss the Bataan Death March when we come back, hearing firsthand from a man who was on it and escaped it. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, listening today to the one-of-a-kind story of Adelano David. Or maybe if you run into him in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where he lives now, you'd call him Al David. You have to call him a survivor. We're going to hear about some situations where the courage of others saved his life, including his escape from the infamous Bataan Death March. Born in the Philippines, Al joined the U.S. Army before America's involvement in World War II. He was serving with the 33rd Infantry Division, the 31st Regiment, and was sent to the Bataan Peninsula. We've heard about the pitiful state of their supplies and equipment. And before we left off, he talked about being ordered to surrender. He didn't want to, but he had no choice. Let's pick up the story there.
When we first surrendered, we were lined up. Anybody found with Japanese money, paper money, or anything, or a sword, or as a souvenir, or anything that has a Japanese marking, the owner, the soldier who had it, was usually beheaded or beaten up. On my own, they tried to take my watch and my military ring, and I objected. And when I objected, the soldier hit me with the butt of his rifle in the belly and on my shins. So. I fell down on my knees, and I was so angry I was going to retaliate when I got up. But a buddy of mine held me back. He said, "Don't, Al, it's going to kill you," because they've done that. And when we gathered together in groups of 100, sometimes groups of 50, to start us on the march. On the march, even before I got too far from the site of surrender, I saw already bodies on the road, bayoneted, and these are not soldiers who were fighting, but they were sick, too sick to go on, with malaria, dysentery. That's when I began to lose hope. I said, "Oh, I'm going to die." Then in the next town, if I have a chance, I'll die trying to escape or escape. And I did that.
So how far into the march was that? How many days?
One day. So when I escaped, at first what my buddies were trying to do was, because I could not stand up anymore, and they could not carry me anymore. I had malaria and dysentery and a shrapnel wound, and I was fainting. So he said, the next chance we have, you better go. When we saw the Japanese away from the guarding us, I tried to escape through the bushes, but they suddenly jerked me back, and they said, I'll wait for another chance. At this point, I decided to die marching because I was scared for some reason or other. No, I got scared. When they saw a gap a few miles afterwards, they saw a gap. They pushed me through the bushes, and I fell across the bushes into a trench dug out by the Filipino occupants of the house by the road. And they covered me with banana leaves and bamboo leaves.
So you get pushed by your friends, who've already saved your life a couple times, it sounds like, by holding you back from retaliating and then telling you not to escape then. They push you into the bushes, you fall into this trench, and you're so weak you don't even know what to do, but these occupants of the house come down and cover you?
I was out for a while because I was sick and thirsty and starving. When I woke up, I was already in the house, and they nursed me for 3 days. On the fourth day, I told them that I had to go, and they pointed me. They gave me a map where to join the rest of the group. Apparently, they had help other people. Many soldiers escaped through the same, so they knew where to go.
And, you know, there are so many great stories about the war in Europe, and we hear about, you know, the Corrie ten Booms of the world and the Anne Frank situation or Oscar Schindler and these people that protected some of the Jews. And we don't hear so many stories about the Pacific, but really these people risked their lives to save yours. How did that make you feel? How indebted did you feel to those folks?
Lifetime. But when I came back, I was back into the MacArthur Liberation Army. I looked for them, but they had moved away already. I know their last names, De La Cruz, but up to now I've not been able to contact them.
And it sounds like you've spent some time trying.
This is the same time I was looking for my sweetheart, and because they had gone to the hills and I didn't know where. So it took me a while to finally give up. So when I finally found where she was home in Manila.
And a lot happened in between there. And I know you have learned a lot over the years. You're involved in the Bataang Corregidor Survivors Group, and you've met a lot of other people who survived the march, and you know how many died on the march. Is there any question in your mind that if you hadn't escaped at that point, that you would have survived or not? What do you think would have happened?
I would have died on the way, because on the way there were cattle cars where we were going to be confined. It was a cow car where only 100 could be, and they were jam-packed. They could not even sit down. I probably would have died of starvation and thirst on the way, or malaria or dysentery, because it was, from where I escaped, it was another 30 miles. And if I escaped the death march and got into the cattle car, car which was going to the concentration camp, I would have died there also, because 100 people died in one car, just from all sicknesses and from lack of air.
So this is the first kind of real miraculous rescue that you experienced. And I know there were more to come, or more situations where you felt that way. But what did you do from there? Because this is still a pretty chaotic spot to be, I imagine. You don't know where it's safe to be. And how did you operate over those weeks and months that followed? What'd you do?
When I joined the underground, our first order was to raid garrisons. And the next order is at midnight, stop trucks with supplies, food and ammunition to Japanese garrisons. After a few raids, we discovered that every time there were casualties in the raids on garrisons, 10 people in the barrios, in the villages, were chosen and executed, man, woman, or child, as long as they could get 10, in retaliation. So we stopped that. So we only started waiting for midnight for trucks to take their supplies and take prisoners. That lasted with me for about 2 months. When I got down with a severe case of malaria, and they sent me to, they smuggled me to Manila, where there was a underground spy ring under the guise of food administration. We, as food administration in the Japanese occupation, the government collaborated in inspecting, like the FDA here, food supplies and the markets, inspecting meat and everything. As such, we were able to, because we supplied the Japanese garrisons, we were able to get an idea how many tanks have arrived, how many airplanes have arrived. And we sent this information to somebody called High Pockets, who was the head of the spy ring in Manila. But cut a long story short, we were discovered, and I escaped again, barely, because I was going to report 9 o'clock to the, it was us in the Metropolitan Theater building, our cell was there, led by Colonel Samoran. And as I entered the compound to get my pay, as I entered the door, my wife's brother's brother-in-law was also an officer. He stopped me and said, "I'll get the hell out of here. The Japanese company have just captured the management." So they captured 10 people, and I hightailed it out of there and went to back to my family, and because the family was with me now, because I was in Manila. And then in the underground newsletter, the next few weeks, I learned that our 10 top men in our cell were beheaded. They were told to dig their graves in the Chinese cemetery, which is not too far from my wife's house, and they beheaded them. And I only remember one name, Colonel Moran, and another name, Borja.
So that would have been your fate too?
Yeah. If I was not delayed, because I was delayed talking to my friend, because we were talking about black market. Because we needed food supplies. We were looking for black market supplies to sell. And I was delayed a few minutes. If I was there in the meeting, I would have been there, me and the other guy.
Yet another close call. And you mentioned your wife. At this time, she's your sweetheart. You hadn't married yet, but then you said it was a while before you saw her again. What was that like when you got to see her? Because I'm sure she had no idea what had happened to you.
She was looking out her window, and she saw me coming, and she had a hunch that it was me. But the maid who opened the garage door, that's where we entered the house, didn't want to admit me because she didn't recognize me. I had long hair and a beard, and I was skin and bones, like somebody on a hanger. I was probably 100 pounds, 109 pounds, out of 153 pounds. So they didn't want to get me in until my wife came down. And of course, you know, how it was. She didn't want to believe it was me because I didn't look like me. But right then and there, we began to plan on eloping because his father wanted to shoot me.
Yet another situation where you beat the odds, I suppose. And again, I think a lot of people just aren't aware of what was happening there in the Philippines because they think, well, America was chased out of there, the death march, MacArthur fled, he said, "I shall return," and then he comes back to Leyte all these years later. But they forget that there were things going on there the whole time, and you were involved in all of that. What kept you believing that your side could win, that this Japanese oppression was not going to be the rest of your life?
What we believed in was air cover and submarines. And I may realize now, I'm a voracious reader and I do research, so I was more aware than my peers about the situation, because I know that back in 1922, the Americans already gave up the Philippines to defend. So to be blunt, we were doomed since 1922 to fight a losing war. A lot of people like MacArthur, and a lot of people dislike him. But as I read more about MacArthur, I find that too much, he has been discredited too much. He was in a fix, and he did what he could. When the papers were covered with the readiness of the Philippine Army. That was his bluff against the Japanese so that they won't attack sooner. So he told the newspapers and Roosevelt that we were quite ready for the Japanese because of our heroism before in the war against Spain, war against America. I was quite welcome to just have an adventure. To me, it was good. To me, it was just going to be an adventure, and I love the recruits who I trained. But the difficulties, we had obsolete arms, and also there were too many dialects in the Philippines to train them properly. There were 12 dialects, one for its island. So what should take the instruction of disassembling a gun or a machine gun and assembling it again, instead of taking one day, took a week. Because one had to interpret to the other.
That makes sense. What can you share about the different things that you did over that time period and what, in general, this underground army was able to accomplish in terms of the big picture and what eventually happened there in the Philippines? What are the things that you feel really proud about that you did and those other guys serving with you were able to do?
Number one, while the spying was operating, we were able to relay to Australia through a smuggled radio the compliments that came in, how many warships, how many airplanes, how many airfields, how many troops. We were able to impart this to Australia, which was related to MacArthur. And what I'm proud of is really that the Filipinos never surrendered to the luring of the Japanese to become one of them. We were too ingrained with American culture, and we considered the Japanese as second-class citizens to us. So we never really assimilated with them. But in fairness to them, they were not all demons. They were educated officers who took care of the sick and who took care of the... Even on the death march, there were Japanese soldiers who gave food to the starving. Stealthily, they gave food to soldiers who were about to fall. So they're not, humanity is complex.
And you've told us about a couple of the what-if situations already, the close calls where it could have ended for you right there. And I'm glad it didn't because you're looking pretty good at 93. I know you have a book coming out in the next year about your experiences. What were some more of those situations over the rest of the war where you look back and say, boy, that was really close. That could have ended it for me right there.
One thing that really scared the hell out of me, after I escaped on the beheading of my people in the spying, I was evacuating my family from the boondocks. I found a Ford wagon to transport my family. My family was my oldest brother was deaf mute. My two brothers, we had sacks of rice, and I didn't know it was contraband. So we were stopped midway between where I took my family from the boondocks to Manila. We were stopped, and a soldier poked his knife, his bayonet, into the stock, and rice came out. So they tied my hands behind my back and took me to the camp. And there was a stump, a tree cut. And they laid my head on the block, and I prayed, and I was almost fainting. I knew this was the end.
But clearly it wasn't the end, or we wouldn't be hearing this story from 93-year-old Atilano David. And we'll find out how he got out of that one, plus find out how he came to work with legendary newsman Edward R. Murrow. All that and more when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, bringing you a story today from one of my favorite places to visit, a city that really knows how to honor its veterans, Albuquerque, New Mexico, where Hometown Heroes airs every Sunday morning at 8 on the Rock of Talk, KIVA. 93-year-old Atilano David lives there in Albuquerque. We've heard this Filipino veteran of World War II describe his escape from the death march, his work in a spy ring led by High Pockets, who, if you've studied your history of the Pacific War, you might know high pockets as an American woman named Claire Phillips. We've heard several situations where Mr. David's life was spared, and when we left off, his head was literally on the chopping block, a Japanese soldier drawing his sword, and our friend Al convinced he was about to die.
And then the officer came with his sword. He said, "Quah!" It's something that he exclaimed. And then they started laughing. It was a big joke. I was so mad. But I could only cry. I could only cry. And everybody was laughing. They had a good laugh at my expense. And my deaf mute brother tried to attack them, but he was held back. When they found out that he was deaf mute, they ignored him. I think that was the scariest time of my life.
Well, I think everyone listening is saying the same thing. They tie your hands behind the back, walk you to a stump, stick your head on it, and draw a sword. So obviously they're going to cut off your head. That's what you're thinking. You said you prayed. What do you pray in a moment like that?
I just prayed Our Father, and that's it. I kept saying Our Father. Because they held me in suspense for a bit. Anyway, when it was over, I was shaken up, and I was sweating. And I could not, because I was driving the van, I couldn't drive anymore. They just put me in the back and lay down.
And I don't want to gloss over anything, so feel free to jump in with any other circumstances that are real memorable to you. But when the Americans returned and were able to recapture all that land and claim the Philippines, what did that mean to you, to your family, to the other Filipinos that you knew? How big a deal was that?
Apparently, it's quite a big deal because we were all skinny from lack of food. And we were in the boondocks, and there was no food but chickens and vegetables. And when I was in the boondocks, suddenly I was paddling a canoe to bring some tomatoes and some spinach, lettuce to my family. And some chicken and eggs, a piper cub came roaring over the treetops and dropping leaflets. And the leaflet said, "I have returned." I didn't waste any time. I took my supplies to my family, got them fed, explained that I had to leave. I don't know when I'll be back. So I was excited. I paddled my canoe through the Pampanga River and got to Palit in Manalin, where I docked my canoe. And I passed, it was in the backyard of a fabulous mansion. It was empty because it was wartime. As soon as I got on the road was dirty and musty and dusty, and everything was covered with brown dust. And then the tank came up. After several troop carriers and tanks came by, I finally flagged one tank, and he got me in. This name is Sergeant James Bell. He was the first guy who was killed in Korea, in top of his tank, writing to his wife. Anyway, he took me in, and he got me to Camp Olivas, where MacArthur was, February 5. So I gave them my dog tag and my record, and they started the 201 file. And right away, I wanted to join the attack on University of Santo Tomas to liberate the 2,500 prisoners. I was refused for some reason or other, because I was skinny, skin and bones. But anyway, Sergeant Bell, we became friends, took me to his tank. We got into his tank, and he showed the movie of them when they had invaded the Philippines, and they showed Japanese from hideouts, caves, coming out burning in flame from the flamethrowers. And my feeling was, I was not animosity. I just felt, I said, humans being burned alive. I was shaken, and I told my friend, "No more. I don't want to see anymore," because he wanted to show me all his exploit from Leyte, island to island, to Luzon. And he showed me nothing but burning soldiers, flamethrowers. So anyway, we became friends. As a matter of fact, I still have his pictures.
Have you ever considered how different things would be in your homeland if the Allies had not found victory over the Japanese?
We did. We considered, we were getting settled to the point that the U.S. had abandoned us. And that although we are facing years and years of Japanese occupation, we were getting adjusted to it, excepting for the atrocities, because their singular ordinary form of punishment is to slap you in the face. To them, that was nothing, because they live with it. And then to the extreme cases where whole villages were massacred. In one town, this was when they learned that the Americans were coming. They lured a whole village into the church, promising them rice and food. And when they locked the church, they set it on fire. And when the door broke down from the fire, the villagers came out and they were shot by machine gun fire. So there were at least about 200. An eyewitness saw that, but he was not in the church.
I can't imagine what that's like to watch that happen. Is that anger or rage or just heartbreak?
At that point where we were already used to hunger and starvation and getting used to deprivation, when we used to be a prosperous nation, we got adjusted. This was rage against the Japanese.
And you said you volunteered to go on the raid of the San Tomas prison camp, and they didn't take you there. But when that eventual victory was reached, when you heard that the Japanese had surrendered, what did that mean to you after everything you'd been through?
By this time, I was assigned to Philippine Army or USAFI headquarters. I was screening insurance forms for GIs in Philippines. And I was also part of the group that was screening guerrillas to find out if they're bona fide guerrillas or just fake guerrillas, which were many. Yeah, they were guerrillas only for one day, but they had many signatures. So I was one of those who screened them. And I happened to publish a mimeograph newsletter for the headquarters called Camp Murphy Newsletter. And I was there. I scooped several American editors for Stars and Stripes, because I was the first one to mention the surrender. I had interviewed and taken notes from these populace who were just shooting guns into the air and just getting drunk with happiness the PJ Day. I found out later that two of those editors who I scooped on this newsletter was one of the became the editor of Los Angeles Times. And the other one was Chicago Times. And that was my role after the surrender. I began to just lead the life of a enlisted man in the headquarters, doing what I could.
That wasn't the end of your journalistic days, though. How was it that you ended up working with Edward R. Murrow?
When I first arrived in the States, I couldn't find a job. But because I enrolled in Columbia U, for film production, TV and film production, they made me an intern. What I was to do was write his news copy from the teletype machine in 25 words or less. So I did that. So later on, I was never one to remain too long in a place. I joined Macy's. I became an advertising copywriter.
What was it that you did with Murrow?
I did summarize the copy that he spoke on the anchor schedule.
You wrote what he read?
I wrote what he read. I edited the teletype copy.
What was he like to work with?
He was a nice person, but he was outspoken. And when I shared this bathroom, it was carpeted with cigarette butts. He was a chain smoker whenever you saw him. And then I finally gave up sharing his bathroom. I had to go to the common bathroom across the hall. But he was a very nice person. But the only problem is when you are an anchor, you usually have your group. Once you are fired or quit, everybody is fired or quit. And he made the mistake of going against William Paley. The first thing you notice when you are at CBS, your secretary is gone. The next day, your telephone is gone. The next day, the desk is gone. It's by the elevator. That he had no human resources, no program like that. It was just be good or out you go. But Ed Morrow had his revenge when he was fired because he didn't get his parachute. So the next day, the Daily News and Daily Post were front page pictures of William Paley and his staff with hookers.
That sounds like revenge. I don't want to leave out anything that's important to you. I also want everyone to pick up your book when it comes out. But when you think back about what you did and what you went through during World War II, what are the things that you're most proud of and most thankful for?
I'm proud of having fought the Japanese with the Americans, because we were under the rule of the Spaniards' cruel sovereignty for 300 years and 200 years with America. So we were Americans at heart. In fact, if you went all the way to the boondocks, you could have got away with English. They spoke English. But I'm proud of the idea that I fought for the U.S., I fought for the Philippines. And my sense of adventure gave me enough pride to write about the heroes, which I am concluding now. And I've been here in the States where I have seen everything. I've seen discrimination here, but I have seen also how good most of my friends and buddies here in the States are Americans, and they have been close buddies for at least 25 years.
You talk about writing about the heroes. Who are the heroes in your eyes?
My hero is the one who substituted for me on my scouting expedition and died for my assignment, because I would have died there. And my heroes also is General Wainwright and General King, because without General King, we would have died on the front just from starvation, or because we were too weak to fight, they would have killed us because they didn't take prisoners. So I'm proud of the fact that I'm an American. I became a citizen in 1973. My wife and I.
You mentioned that you had tried to find that family, De La Cruz, that you talked about, that had harbored you and saved your life. I wonder, too, about those men who pushed you into the ditch, into the bushes. Did they survive the march? Did you ever find out?
No, because on the march, 12,000 Filipinos died in 35 miles, and 6,000 Americans died in 35 miles, and then another 1,000 every day at the camp. So they're probably one of those, because they were also starving and thirsty. I've never heard of them.
Do you ever ask yourself, why? Why me? Why did all these things happen at the right time so I could survive? And if so, what's your answer?
Somebody up there likes me. St. Peter is not ready for me yet. Yeah, and I've had the close escapes even in civilian life. I'm still here.
You're still here, still going strong. And one of the things you've done in more recent years is you designed a memorial to those who suffered and died on the Bataan Death March. Tell me about that memorial, what inspired it, and how people can see it.
Well, I remember a Filipino wife extending a ladle of water to two soldiers, one American, one Filipino, and that stuck in my mind. So one day, I was already in Orlando. I was publishing my own magazine in Orlando. Somebody came one day knocking at my door, and he said, "Are you Talano David?" "Yes," I said. "We have learned that you know how to draw and how to paint. That's one of my paintings there." I said, "Yeah. Well, we would like you to draw a concept of a memorial, and I want you to draw what you remember." So I drew a Filipino woman giving aid to two guys. Then they made a sculpture out of it, and they made a bronze life-size statue and put it in the front of Lake Kissimmee in Kissimmee, Florida, which is about 3 or 4 miles south of Disney World. And at the inauguration, I was the guest speaker for having designed that thing. And I had a Filipino general and an American general as guest speakers. I probably made a very good speech, because the generals, the two of them, has asked me for a copy so that they could use it in their own gatherings. So I was kind of complimented on that. And then they told me that my drawings will be in a time capsule to be opened in 100 years beneath the statue. Wow. It's now a tourist thing. It's life-size, facing the lake.
I know you can't recite the whole speech from memory, but if they complimented you on the speech and said it was so great, I'm sure people at home are saying, well, what did he say? Do you remember what the crux of your presentation was and what it was you were trying to express?
Well, the thing that made women cry in the audience was when I said, this memorial is to honor your brothers and sisters, uncles and sons, and they're still with you, sitting beside you, celebrating this occasion. There was one who fainted, and they told me about it. So I was kind of flattered because, somebody from the boondocks in the Philippines, here in the United States, making Americans cry. These are the things that I remember as my years are going by.
93 years young. Well, and I'm sure you brought tears to a few other people's eyes today with some of the stories you told. I just want to say thank you for serving our country, for serving your original country, the Philippines, for fighting for freedom and for being able to share that legacy with us. Is there anything else that you think we should know?
I am so happy that there's now a move to recognize all the veterans living or dead here in Albuquerque or California or Texas. And I just learned that there's a move which is gathering strength about the recognition of Filipinos who were not recognized properly. In fact, they were denied benefits at one time. I feel that at last we are given the recognition we deserve.
Well, I think everybody who has listened for the last hour will agree it is most certainly deserved. If you'd like to see photos of Mr. David and of that beautiful memorial he inspired in Florida, go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and keep an eye out for his upcoming book. I'll let you know when it hits the shelves. We're out of time on this edition of Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.